Welcome to this episode of Title Now. Hi, I'm Melissa Murphy, General Counsel at the Fund, and we host these webinars from time to time on issues of interest to the title industry and to the real estate settlement industry. Try to come up with timely topics that you need to know about. Sometimes we revisit and update old topics. You just never know. But we push the audio portion of this webinar out to our podcast, which is also called, conveniently, Title Now. And you can get the podcast anywhere you subscribe to your other podcasts, and it's free. So it's a great way for you to listen to the content again, preserve the content, share it with colleagues and friends who might also be interested. So please become a subscriber. I would like to see those numbers go up, so I would appreciate that. So there's a lot of buzz in the industry about the changes in the way real estate commissions are supposed to be handled, all as a result of the National Association of Realtors settlement of several class actions. What exactly are these changes? Realtors and closing agents are just starting to really zero in on what are the new rules, what do the documents need to say, what documents to use, and how is this all going to work out in the marketplace. We've already hosted one webinar that focused on the new documents issued by Florida Realtors. And these are forms that Florida Realtors developed for realtors to use that comply with the new rules. Now, we are learning that some brokers around the state have come up with their own forms, but the rules are what they are. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Everybody has to comply with the new rules. So a month or so has gone by since that webinar, and we thought it was time to check in and have a discussion about how things are going, what are we hearing from members, what are we hearing from title agents across the state, what are we hearing from brokers. And so with me is our new Deputy General Counsel, Shannon Widman. Shannon comes to the fund with 25 years of experience. She practiced law in Walton County up in the Panhandle, and her firm was a fund top contributor for several years. So Shannon has handled lots of closings, and she has strong relationships with the brokers out there. So welcome, Shannon.
Thank you, Melissa.
A little bit of housekeeping. If you have questions that you want to pose to us, post them in the questions section over in the panel. Should be on the right-hand side of your screen. Our infamous Michael Rothman is here to monitor your questions, and we will try to respond to several of them at the end of the presentation, but if we can't get to it, we will try to respond to you directly. So first off, Shannon, let's remind our listeners of the main points of the new rules. I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah, by now, real estate professionals have seen the forms. They've started using them. They know that there can be no offer of compensation to be paid to a buyer's broker in the MLS, not even sneaky ones. The seller can, however, still offer to compensate the buyer's broker. They can spell that out through the listing agreement or through negotiations when an offer is made, either directly or indirectly, depending on the structure of the negotiation. Ideally, the buyer's broker knows what the deal is before the offer is made, and we'll go into that more today. But some brokers are using the new Florida Realtor forms and some have adopted their own. But in any event, all the buyer broker agreements must contain the disclosure that broker commissions are not set by law and they're fully negotiable. And that has to be in bold print. Before a realtor can work with a buyer, tour a home virtually or in person, they must enter into a written agreement with the buyer. And there's lots of confusion about this part. This written buyer broker agreement must provide for the buyer to pay the broker an amount that is objectively ascertainable. This cannot be a range of payment. It can't say whatever the seller is willing to pay. A buyer's broker may not receive more than what this agreement reflects, even if the seller is willing to pay more. And if they want to change that later through modified terms, they can do that, but it has to be in writing.
Whoa, there is so much to unpack in what you just said. And so let's try to do that in the 30 minutes we have. So let's start with one of the first things you said, and that's the prohibition of any mention on the MLS of compensation to the buyer broker. So how does a buyer broker find out if the seller is willing to pay something?
Well, they pick up the phone. You know, this could be a lot more work than a broker's used to doing because the buyer might want to see several homes, and they may only want to see homes where there's going to be some sort of offer of compensation to offset the buyer's costs. Some listing agents have included what the seller is willing to offer on their websites. A broker can include this info within their website, but they better be sure that it's separated from the IDX information that's pulled through to the MLS, because it cannot be in the MLS. A listing agent can leave flyers in the home, maybe on the kitchen counter. It could be on a sign in the front yard. Just be sure you don't take a picture of the house with the sign in the front yard and throw that picture up on the MLS. They can advertise a seller concession in the MLS, but only in areas where the local MLS rules allow for that.
All right, and we'll talk about concessions in a little bit more detail in a minute, but this part of it was interesting to me, that it can't be in the MLS, but there are lots of ways that the listing broker can communicate to the buyer and a buyer broker what the seller is willing to pay. So it'll be very interesting to hear stories about how they do that. But what if they don't do any of that? And what if the information is nowhere to be found and the listing agent doesn't respond to phone calls or emails? Have you heard that that's even happening?
Unfortunately, yes, that happens too. So the best solution to difficult listing agents, just have your buyer make an offer that includes the compensation that they want the seller to pay to the buyer's broker. And this can be included in the other provisions section of the FAR bar contract, or they can use one of the two new riders that just came out.
So I think I heard you say two riders. So why are there two different riders?
Yeah, so the FAR bar committee came out with two new riders to the contract. The first is FF. Rider FF talks about a seller credit to the buyer. It's basically a seller concession that will offset the compensation that a buyer is otherwise obligated to pay their agent. And then there is GG. GG is a contingency rider that's used when the seller is going to pay the buyer's broker either directly or indirectly through the listing agent. Then if you use GG, you have to use one of two other forms, the CASB or the CABB. And those are compensation agreements that link the contract obligations from the buyer and seller to the buyer broker agreement.
All right. So let's back up just a little bit for a second. So Rider FF asks the seller to credit the buyer with the amount that the buyer wants the seller to pay toward their broker's compensation. If the credit is not equal to what the buyer broker is to be paid, how do you deal with that? Is that in a separate agreement, or it's just understood that the buyer has to pay that difference?
Well, whatever the buyer broker agreement states is the maximum amount. So if that agreement is higher than what the seller is offering to contribute as a concession, then the buyer could be responsible for paying the difference. But the buyer and the broker could agree to amend their buyer broker agreement to match the seller concession. The NAR FAQs are really helpful in these circumstances. They're being updated constantly because real estate professionals are asking these same questions as they're getting used to these new forms.
So then the other rider, GG, creates a contingency on an agreement being entered into between the seller and either the buyer broker or between the listing broker and the selling broker to deal with the compensation. Have I got that right?
That's right. And it's a contingency that provides 3 days for one of those two agreements to be entered, whichever way they're structuring the agreement. And basically, they have to do that because the contract, if you remember, the underlying contract is just between a buyer and a seller. There's no promise to pay an agent in there other than to each other. So the agent is insured payment through the CABB or the CASB.
Got it. All right. So the offer is made and the buyer broker don't know what the seller is willing to pay or even has agreed to pay. So if the offer made says seller agrees to pay 2% toward the buyer broker because that's the amount that is in the buyer broker agreement, and the seller says, sure, I'll pay 2%, but it turns out that the seller had agreed in the listing agreement, and we'll talk about that in a minute, to pay 3% toward the buyer broker compensation. And the buyer broker finds this out somehow. Well, can the buyer broker get 3%?
Not without amending their buyer broker agreement to match that. Some agents feel like they're just going to miss out and they're selling themselves short. But if they happen to find out what the listing agreement says, then and their buyer won't agree to amend their buyer broker agreement, then they can only get the maximum.
But if there's already a signed contract where the offer was pay my broker 2% and the seller agrees to that, there may not be anything that can be done. All right, well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about that buyer broker agreement, because in my mind, based on my experience, this is a whole new thing. And it's something that Florida realtors need to get used to, but also consumers. So what does that entail?
Well, in general, agents are having a hard time explaining the new buyer broker agreements to their buyers. Some buyers have heard that they can save money on a purchase by just not using a broker. They just go on the internet, they go on Zillow, they find some properties they like, and they just contact all the listing agents to see the properties. But the new rules do not allow them to even view the properties virtually or in person without signing something. There are limited showing agreements or pre-touring agreements that some agents might be willing to offer to a buyer. But in talking to the real estate professionals around the state, brokers don't want to work for free, and who could blame them? So they explain to buyers that they can structure the offer and ask the seller to contribute directly or indirectly to offset the agent compensation, but it may not happen that way. So buyers need to understand that they're responsible for the payment to their own agent if the seller doesn't come to an agreement on there.
Let me ask you this, that if a buyer, you know, has heard that they don't need their own broker, that they can save money by contacting the listing agent directly, the listing agent has to tell them, I can't show you the home until you sign an agreement with me, right?
That's correct. Absent an open house situation where a listing agent is just performing kind of a ministerial duty to open it up to the buyers, buyers otherwise need to sign something.
Okay, so if there's not an open house, you know, an official open house, then the listing agent probably does need to get something signed with that buyer to give them a special viewing of the home. But if it's just a Saturday or Sunday afternoon open house, the buyer can go and wander around the house, and the listing agent is somewhat limited in the types of conversations they can have with the buyer.
That's right. And transaction broker rules still apply.
So how can a fund member help agents or brokers that that they represent that are used to representing buyers? How can they help them navigate this new world of buyer broker agreements?
Well, they may want to consider helping them articulate their value proposition to buyers. They can help prepare the agents and brokers on what to say when a buyer says, I think I can save money by not using you. Maybe they tell the agent, okay, well, ask your buyers, who's going to call the listing agents and arrange for the showings? Are they going to pay a separate attorney to drop the contract? That may be more expensive than using an agent. Where do they even get the contract form to use? Is the listing agent going to help them out for free in that regard? Fund members can also draw the attention to brokers on the two new sections of the buyer broker agreement, the retainer section and the new indemnification provision section. They really need to look at that a little bit.
And our audience needs to understand that the buyer broker agreement that was prepared by Florida Realtors is a contract. It's a full-fledged contract between the buyer and a broker, a buyer broker. And while Florida Realtors certainly has a philosophy of treating consumers as fairly as possible, the agreement is, in many respects, drawn in favor of the broker. There are certainly provisions in there that a fund member that represents a buyer, if they are lucky enough to have the buyer bring them the broker agreement before they sign it, they might want to look at. Now, I think I've heard a lot of brokers around the state and folks from Florida Realtors say, you know, it's a suggested form. It's not a required form. It is a suggested form. And brokers can modify the agreement. They can cross out the retainer portion of the form if that's just not what they're comfortable doing. Which may be why some brokers have come up with their own form, for sure. But I think there will be attorneys out there that will be concerned about what's in the buyer broker agreement and will want to fully explain that to a client of theirs that's a buyer. What are some of the other provisions in that buyer broker agreement that a fund member might want to draw to the attention of a buyer?
They look like harmless sections, but they really need to pay attention to the basic sections on the first page, the term of the agreement, how long is it good for, and the geographic area that the agreement covers. I've heard stories about buyers signing multiple buyer brokerage agreements, not realizing that the geographic location overlapped. Ooh. And getting into situations where they could possibly owe two commissions to two separate agents. The one story I heard of, that one worked out, thankfully, but that could be a mess.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah. And then the maximum compensation provision. Make sure the buyer understands this agreement states the maximum you'll be paying. And then let them know that they haven't even entered into the contract yet, so this agreement can be adjusted. There's a modification form that can easily adjust the terms on the agreement to match what their contract ends up saying.
All right. Well, sounds complicated enough and something that people will need to get used to. But let's turn back to the seller and let's talk about a document that we are at least somewhat familiar with, and that would be the listing agreement. What are the options presented to the seller in the listing agreement in this new world?
Yeah, so the listing agreement has all the options. The agreement can authorize the seller's broker to pay the buyer's broker, kind of the old school traditional sharing of compensation. The listing agreement could authorize the seller to just pay the buyer broker directly on the settlement statement. Really, there's no difference between the broker paying that and the seller paying that when you're in an escrow situation anyway, but it authorizes that. The seller could pay zero towards a buyer broker compensation, or the seller could offer a concession to the buyer. But in any event, agents need to be sure that they're complying with the NAR standard of practice 16-16 that states an agent's compensation may not be negotiated through the contract. It can be accounted for in the contract, but not negotiated through it. For instance, you can't say, I'm not going to present this offer to you, broker, until I know how I'm going to get paid.
That's a new new aspect of this new world. All right. So the seller has options there. I wonder what types of conversations listing agents will have with sellers about which option they believe a seller should select, or how they explain the pros and cons of those different options. Okay. But one of the things that I'm hearing people talk about a lot is this concession idea. So let's talk about that. How does this work vis-a-vis compensation paid to a buyer broker?
Well, first you need to know, can the listing agent advertise the concession in the MLS? That depends on the local MLS rules. So they need to know what their local MLS rules are with regard to advertising the concession. Then say it's all right to advertise and they go through and they want to structure a contract that way. Is there a gap between the amount the seller concession and the amount of compensation in the buyer broker agreement? A buyer is going to be responsible for coming out of pocket to pay the difference if the buyer broker agreement states a higher amount, unless, again, it's modified by some sort of written document later. Is the buyer financing the transaction? Seller concessions are scrutinized by some lenders. A lot of lenders have a cap on IPCs, which are interested party compensation. You have to know if it's a VA loan. Although the VA has come out and said that a concession to pay a buyer's broker is okay, and they offered a circular on that. It's circular 26-24-14 until they take a more permanent position. But these broker fees may not be rolled up like the other closing costs can be into the loan amount. So the buyer may end up having to come out of pocket a little more. And these charges are considered in a buyer's loan application as part of their overall liquidity, factoring into loan approval. So with all of this, brokers need to be able to articulate their value proposition. And it's a huge opportunity for fund members to do the same with brokers.
Agreed. Here's a question that I've heard. Are the selling agents and listing agents obligated to share their forms with each other?
No, they're not obligated to. However, NAR encourages the agents to have verbal discussions prior to offer submittal. So they do encourage the conversations to be open with a buyer's agent about what structure the offer should be to appease, you know, basically to match what the seller has in the listing agreement, but there's no obligation there.
So if a closing agent gets copies of, let's say, the buyer broker agreement from the buyer broker so that they know what to charge the buyer, are they obligated to keep that confidential?
There's no duty of confidentiality yet, but somehow you need to get it clear between both brokers who's being paid and what amounts and how is it going to be structured. So a realtor estoppel form would be ideal for the closing agent to use, but there's not a form out there unless they've made one themselves. So we do want to know from fund members, you know, how are you handling this? Do you have your own system? Do you have your own estoppel form? And what other things have changed for you as a closing agent since this settlement?
I think that is certainly the topic of conversation amongst closing agents. You know, how are you handling this? What are you getting? And I can just see all kinds of logistical challenges of getting an estoppel agreement signed or disbursement authorization, whatever you call it. And who needs to sign that? It's the broker that needs to sign that, not the listing agent, not the selling agent. It's the broker that needs to sign that. And that's a new wrinkle too. So throughout this, you've kind of mentioned situations where fund members could play a role. So what do you suggest fund members do to take advantage of the various opportunities presented by all these changes?
Do presentations to your local board. Invite groups of brokers and agents to your office. Get in front of them. Do a presentation. Help them articulate their value proposition. And as a result, it helps you articulate your own. At the fund, we're working on a PowerPoint presentation that fund members can use to present these issues to their local boards, and it'll be out soon. And meanwhile, the final settlement approval of the class action lawsuits that started all of this is scheduled for November 26th.
And I think we're kind of holding on that PowerPoint presentation until that final hearing because we don't know how that might change things. I'm certainly not in the prediction business when it comes to what a court might do. So there's a lot to unpack here. There are, I think, tremendous opportunities for fund members to show their value to the primary source of business, referrals of business to them, the real estate industry. And so I hope they'll take advantage of it. So Michael, are you still there? Do we have any good questions?
We've got a lot of questions. Do these rules, these new practices apply to both residential and commercial real estate transactions?
I think it's only residential. Yeah.
It's only Shannon's residential.
Problem. Only residential.
I like this question. Can a buyer insert a contingency in the buyer brokerage agreement, making it voidable if the seller hasn't agreed to pay the buyer broker so that the buyer is not on the hook for a fee to the buyer's broker? Put a contingency in there that says, unless we get the other side to pay, we're in agreement, I'm not paying you.
I think that the ruling authority, and we'll talk about that in a minute, might very well view that as going against the whole philosophy and basis for this settlement. What do you think, Shannon?
I agree. It wouldn't be readily ascertainable. I mean, if it can't be a range, so it can't be 0 to X%, right?
Well, then let me ask this question, because it's along the same lines. Can the buyer broker agreement be for 3% unless the seller's concession is less? In which case, the compensation will be for the lower amount.
That's a range. So the solution is to modify the buyer's broker agreement when you're submitting the offer. If you know that the circumstance you're heading into is where the seller is offering a 0.5% less than what you've agreed to in the buyer's broker agreement, then it's smart to just modify your buyer's broker agreement with there's a simple modification form that they've come out with.
Can't you just draft it that says what I just said, but add a sentence to the buyer brokerage agreement, in which event buyer's broker agrees today to a modification?
Agreement to contract in the future. It's kind of a law school question right there.
That's an agreement to agree, but... Right. It makes the buyer feel better, right?
Yeah. Let me interrupt for just a second, because I think it's interesting to point out that the enforcement entity for these new rules might surprise you. It's the MLS. And so if you violate the rules, the various MLSs can fine you as a member of the MLS. And I think those fines are pretty significant, Shannon. They do vary from MLS to MLS, but that's who's going to pin the ears back of a realtor if they violate the MLS. So we need to get some answers. These are great questions. Thank you all. One more.
Are we as closing agents obligated to obtain and look at these buyer broker compensation agreements to police the commission agreement not being higher than the original contract?
I'm going to say no, that is not our obligation.
It's an interesting question, because what these new forms do is they incorporate the agreement of the agents with their respective parties into the buyer and seller's contract. So we talked about GG, that's a contingency form that is now incorporated into the buyer's contract. And when they sign one of the other related forms, CABB or CASB, you're kind of bringing all the parties together. So where the contract was just privity between the buyer and seller, now you've kind of added a link to make the realtors part of that. So if it's a closing agent's duty to close in accordance with the contract, they should be able to have some reliable information. That's why I think that a realtor estoppel form is probably going to be a really smart way for closing agents to be able to rely upon the information given to them. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how best to implement that sort of form.
Excellent. Thank you, Michael. For those questions that we didn't get a chance to respond to or comment on, I'm not sure we did respond. I'm not sure we answered them all. We will try to respond to you directly, or we might, once we see all these questions, we may say, oh, we need a follow-up webinar. Oh, we need to do some more research. Because this is not the last webinar that we're going to do on this topic, because this is a whole new world for us to learn about and figure out, because that's what we do. So I want to thank everybody that participated today and listened to our comments. We really appreciate it. Send me your comments, your ideas for future webinars, because we love to hear from fund members. And as Shannon requested, send us, you know, your scenarios of situations that you're dealing with and how you're addressing those on your transactions. Don't forget, we push the audio out on our podcast, so please register for the podcast. And as always, thank you for your support of the fund.